Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. I'll be keeping you company for the next hour here on News Talk as we look at some of the major stories in business and politics from here in Ireland and around the world. Coming up on today's show, big news in the tech industry as the US and the UK link in a groundbreaking agreement that sets the stage for global cooperation on artificial intelligence. Plus, we dive into the boardroom shakeup at Boeing and what it means for the aviation giant, which is responsible for a whopping 42% market share of the aircraft that you'll be travelling on this year. And as we brace ourselves for the reign of Simon Harris and a political reshuffle, we reflect on past missteps with top analysts John Downing and Jared Howland. You can email me about any of these items on takingstock@newstalk.com. I'm also open on Twitter at StockNT. Well, first up today, we're going to take a look at Simon Harris as he prepares for his election as Taoiseach. The question of who will be in his cabinet is on everyone's mind at the moment. And while the need for stability between the parties is surely a factor, he also has to keep an eye on the fate of Fine Gael as we edge closer to an election. Can he learn from past reshuffles? So that's the question that was on our minds. And what worked and what can go horribly wrong in the past? So we were thinking of how we might look at that today. And someone else who was looking at that this week was John Downing, who is a journalist for Media House Ireland covering the Irish Independent and the Sunday Independent. He joins me on the line, and I'm also joined by Gerald Howland, public affairs consultant, political commentator and former senior government advisor. Gentlemen, you're both very welcome to Taking Stock.
Hello, Mandy.
Hello, Mandy.
Now, I don't know whether it's good fortune or misfortune, but we've all soldiered together behind the scenes in the past, so we see how the sausage is made. And Gerry, I'm going to start with you by asking you, what are the principles going into a reshuffle? What does a incoming Taoiseach have to think of?
Principle is to come out of a reshuffle without having made enemies who would subsequently decapitate and kill you. It's not more complicated than that. Reshuffles are extremely dangerous. The fact that Simon Harris was not reshuffled by Leo Varadkar really set him up subsequently to wait for the day that arrived. The fact that Enda Kenny tried and failed after a bad election for Kenny in 2016 to shuffle Varadkar back into health, Varadkar refused. He moved. That allowed Harris come into cabinet. It allowed Varadkar escape to social protection. It preserved Varadkar's momentum and credibility, which he used in short order to finish off the job he had long been at in relation to undermining and doing in and beginning.
John, I'll bring you in here. They're all great examples of what can go wrong. In terms of a principle, the things that someone has to consider when they're Taoiseach, like gender, geography, can you just take us through those basic principles?
Well, certainly the current government has been accused of being very East Coast. Women are also frequently scarce, for particularly those who would have enough experience and political nous to make a cut at the thing. There's also a question of whether or not do you keep your enemies close or do you banish them into outer darkness where they can have fun on the back benches conspiring and generally storing up future trouble. There is also the question of horses for courses. I mean, the permanently problematic departments are usually, these days, health and housing. They have been for a very long time. Do you have somebody who has the communication skills to be able to carry that, to be able to put a better gloss on things?
Gerry, this is quite a unique time to be reshuffling for Simon Harris as he enters government. Is there any reshuffle that has happened in the past that you could kind of compare this to in terms of timing, in terms of the popularity of a government?
So the last time a reshuffle was tried really to freshen up a party before an election that I remember was Gareth Fitzgerald in the late 1980s. He tried to move Barry Desmond out of the Department of Health. Barry Desmond refused, caused chaos. Gemma Hussey was moved out of education against her will into what was then called social welfare. He, Fitzgerald, fired three Fine Gael junior ministers, stored up a lot of sort of bad feeling among the more rural Fine Gael types at the time. Didn't work, didn't do anything, and served largely to cause ill feeling, I would say. Reshuffles are beloved of media and pot stirrers and hurlers on the ditch. They have much less utility in the practical practice of effective politics and government.
Oh yeah, we don't care about that, Jerry. We just want to talk about what went wrong. John, I'm going to bring you in here to my favourite one. It's the Longford slasher cabinet massacre moment, Albert Reynolds of 1992. 8 minutes, I think, it took him to sack members of the cabinet. Can you just take us through the background of that reshuffle, what he was facing into and what he did and what happened after?
Yeah, Albert says something positive about Albert first. A very likeable man, particularly from a journalist point of view, very user-friendly, and a key person in laying the foundations for peace in the North. That being said, he was some boy. He finally ousted Charlie Haughey, to whom he had been loyal for years. He finally ousted him in February 1982. As you say, he did the father and mother of a clear out. Mainly they were long time Haughey loyalists, but they were household names. People like Ray Burke, Mary O'Rourke, and particularly Gerard Collins from Limerick, who had been a key feature of Irish public life for more than 20 years. He at the time there were 12 junior ministers. He sacked 9 of those. So three quarters of the junior team, more than half of the senior team. Then he went on to promote a lot of people, questionable really in retrospect. David Andrews, these were principally Haughey enemies. David Andrews, Seamus Brennan, Charlie McCreevy. And he did bring in 2 young rural TDs, Noel Dempsey and Brian Cowan, names for the future. Charlie Haughey's ally and protege, your own old pal, Mandy, Bertie Ahern, he stayed on as finance minister, mainly because he had agreed not to challenge Albert Reynolds for the leadership of the party. It was the so-called Reynolds-Ahern dream team. But Bertie Ahern watched very closely what followed from such a mass clear out, and He Bertie Ahern, went on to be Taoiseach for 11 more years. Mm. He was always far more conservative in any team changes he made. I remember him saying, well, I've changed 3 ministers on this occasion, and I think that's as much as the traffic will take. That's as much as you can do. Albert was unlucky for some reasons and other reasons. He couldn't do coalition, which really went against him. He broke up 2 coalitions. Mm. But his big clear out, I think, as Gerard said there at the start, his big clear out, I think, sowed the seeds of his own early demise in politics.
Yeah, well, he certainly wasn't a man to do things by halves. But Gerard, John raises an interesting point there about bringing new people in, you know, Noel Dempsey, Dermot Ahern, Bertie Ahern even at that time. But even if we go back to Gareth Fitzgerald's 1986 reshuffle, like you saw Enda Kenny coming in as his first attempt at being junior ministry, he'd already been 10 years in the Dáil at that stage, right? And there was this systematic, I suppose, incremental promotion path, which was you're on a committee, you're on chair of a committee, you're a junior minister, and you're a minister. Now what we see more and more of is you're a first-time TD, you're a minister, you're straight in.
So I think we're using the word shuffle and reshuffle really loosely, Mandy. Mm. I think it would give listeners a sense of there being more cards in the hand than there actually are. Mm. Fine Gael got 35 TDs at the last election, down 15. One of those 35 promptly left, Owen Murphy. Fine Gael lost the by-election. Of the 34 remaining, 12 are retiring, and in that 12, I'm counting Leo Varadkar and Simon Coveney, which I know they're officially not retirees yet, but that's my calculation. And that leaves, excluding those who are not ministers, hardly a dozen who are not, who may be eligible for consideration. And of those, we know there are one or two Lutermans who shouldn't be minister for anything ever. So actually, the number of choices that Simon Harris has
is minimal.
Minimal. But the amount of upset he can cause by leaving anyone behind is astonishing.
John, you were looking at more of these attempted reshuffles this week, and you also talked about Enda Kenny's effort in 2014 to save what was then the Fine Gael Labour coalition and bring them back from all the hardship that they had to, I suppose, inflict on the public and try and rescue them for the next election. Talk us through what Enda Kenny was facing, what he tried to do.
Yeah, this was June 2014. A lot of people will remember that Fine Gael and Labour, they had been in power from 2011. They had been dishing out the harsh medicine. There was some suggestion, particularly by Labour, that they wouldn't, that they could soften the demands of the EU, IMF, the ECB, the dreaded Troika, who were basically running the Irish economy at the time. But local elections in May 2014 confirmed Enda Kenny's worst fears, and indeed those of Eamon Gilmore, who was the star in many ways of the general election in 2011. They had disastrous local elections. Fine Gael lost control of many of the councils where they had a majority. They fell behind Fianna Fáil, which was enjoying something of a revival under Micheál Martin. Labour lost more than half their councillors, and Eamon Gilmore was forced to very promptly quit as leader. They had an election. Joan Burton became the new Labour leader. She and Enda Kenny unveiled a hugely changed team in late June 2014. They pledged that, look, we're near the end of the austerity here. We are going to have an economic recovery very shortly, which was proven true by events. There were lots of changes. Leo Varadkar moved from transport to health. James Riley, the ill-starred James Riley, moved from health to the Department of Children. Charlie Flanagan had been in that job. He became the new Minister for Foreign Affairs. There were two new people from Labour who had been around the junior ranks. Alan Kelly, a future leader. He went to Environment and the Poison Chalice of Housing. Jan O'Sullivan moved into Education. And then we saw the introduction of two newcomers on the Fine Gael side, relatively new TDs. Heather Humphreys became the Arts Minister, and Pascal Donoghue moved into to Leo Varadkar's old job in the Department of Transport.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so all those names kind of now, in just a couple of years, I suppose, becoming key linchpins in Fine Gael now, and their future is closely watched. Gerard, I'll bring you back in here for a second, because probably the most spectacular, I don't know if you can even call it a reshuffle, is Brian Cowan in 2011, where things were kind of happening and he had to move the deck chairs around the Titanic. You're right in what you're saying, like, to the general public, none of this matters because they don't care. But, like, you know, for us anoraks watching it, that was quite the day, wasn't it?
It was an extraordinary day, and it wasn't so much a reshuffle because all the cards fell on the floor.
Yeah, exactly.
The reshuffle was never completed, and John Downing would be very aware of these events.
Of course, because the Greens then.
And John was a special officer in that cause at that time. That Brian Cowan attempted foolishly to continue on in government after the Greens had left office, that he was appointing Fianna Fáil deputies to the vacant positions. It was completely incredible that the government could go on. Several who were offered promotions refused. I think Pat Carey was minister for several departments momentarily. It was an absolute complete fracas.
John, I guess looking back at that, it's much easier covering these reshuffles than being in the middle of one.
It is, absolutely. You have a sense of powerlessness. I have one of these, where were you moments when you heard And I was actually at the railway station on the way home. I just got into my car and the 11 o'clock news came on with details of some of the things that Gerard is talking about there. And I was going, oh, Christ, what now? So I get on the phone and I'm told from the Green side of things, look, there's no way this is happening. And, you know, pack your comics soon, really soon, because we won't be here terribly long more.
Yeah, and that is the reality of what things are like behind the scenes very often in politics, Gerard. I just want to ask you one final question on this, if I can. Gerard, first to you, somebody said to me during the week, Simon Harris is expected to knock down and refurbish a house. He'll probably end up wallpapering a bedroom. Maybe he'll, you know, stretch to a Dermot Bannon extension. What do you think? Do you think he's going to be conservative?
Well, he may as well be bold, because conservative won't work. Bold is unlikely to work either, but at least you'd have the satisfaction of having tried. Time is his enemy. The clock is against him. He has literally a political instant to repackage Fine Gael. He doesn't have sufficient time to reinvent it. You're going into local European elections on the 7th of June. I predict an election this autumn. He could be extremely lucky, but he would require the proverbial flash of lightning for that luck to strike.
John, do you concur with Gerard?
I would say yes to all of that. I would think for Simon Harris to be Taoiseach at the other side of a general election, we'd need the country to be struck by a meteorite or something like that. I would say, above all else, the thing I would say about reshuffles is far too much is expected of them by the party faithful, by the activists and party members. Time is not on Simon Harris's side. This time next year, we will definitely be in the aftermath of a general election. If it doesn't happen earlier, as Gerard Howlin has said just now. But I think Simon Harris will be bold, but I don't think his efforts will work.
Well, look, we're truly living in interesting times. Over the past number of weeks, we've had the word earthquake, nuclear explosions, and now meteorites mentioned in relation to what's happening in politics. So we'll keep an eye on it all. But for now, we're going to have to leave it there. That was Gerard Howlin, public affairs consultant, political commentator and former senior government advisor. And John Downing, journalist for Media House Ireland, covering the Irish Independent and the Sunday Independent. Thank you both very much for joining me today. After the break, I'll be joined by Zach Wichter from USA Today to talk about the management shakeup at Boeing. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Taking Stock here on News Talk. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, the past few months for Boeing has been nothing but one bad news story after another. We saw its CEO step down, and before that, they had serious safety issue questions for the airline. So why is this happening now, and what does the future look like for the aircraft manufacturer? Well, travel reporter and cruising altitude columnist for USA Today, Zach Wichter, joins me now to parse through the chaos that is at Boeing. Zach, you're very welcome to News Talk.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here. And you asked some really great and big questions in your lead-in. Why is this happening now? I think it's because essentially we saw this major safety incident with Alaska Airlines at the start of the year when that piece of the fuselage blew out during a flight. That has brought Boeing back into the spotlight for its safety reputation. Mm. And the 737 MAX in particular has had questions kind of hovering over it for years since those two crashes in Indonesia and Ethiopia a few years ago killed 346 people and really brought questions about Boeing's safety practices and standards kind of to the forefront. This seems to just be a continuation of that. Mm. And really, it's not entirely clear how it ends. The experts who I've spoken to in my reporting say that the sort of sum total of this is calling for a major culture change at Boeing. And that sort of change can be hard to implement. And there isn't really a clear path to get to where Boeing needs to be just yet.
And as I mentioned in the introduction there, their CEO stepped down, Dave Colquhoun, was originally, of course, brought in to solve some of those problems that you mentioned. As he departs now, what will his legacy within the company be?
So obviously, we have seen him oversee the company at a time where its safety reputation continues to be a question. You know, the Federal Aviation Administration here in the U.S. is stepping up oversight of Boeing and its production practices, really auditing the way that it does things, asking hard questions about what happened. So he's going out. I mean, he will be here, be at Boeing through the end of the year, but he's still going out under kind of a cloud of what is this great American company turning into and what is it going to become?
And that's a really good point, this great American company. We kind of sometimes forget on this side of the water just how big a company it is. Am I right in thinking that their company is split in terms of where it's based, with its manufacturing operations in Seattle and then its corporate entity elsewhere?
That's absolutely correct. So Boeing does manufacturing both in Seattle and also in South Carolina for its 787, which is its newest wide-body jet. And then its headquarters is actually in Chicago, I believe. And there's also a big corporate presence in Washington, D.C. They may actually be moving the headquarters to Washington, D.C. But that's been a big criticism of Boeing for many years, essentially since they moved their headquarters to Chicago. So it used to be that everything with Boeing was based in Washington State. And when they moved the corporate offices out of Washington, away from the factories, it became a really big point of contention for a lot of people that they seem to be moving the business side away from the engineering and kind of the product and the safety behind that product. And so that's been a big point of criticism and a big question through all of this is, was that the right decision? And what does it actually mean for Boeing's products to have their executives so far away from the factory floor? Mm.
So, yeah, that's definitely a legacy issue. And as you mentioned there, the culture of the company is so important in this type of a shakeup. So what else is happening there? What other people have been moved around the chess board at the moment, and who's incoming and who's outgoing?
That's a great question. So a lot of executives have been shuffled or moved out of the company as part of the changes that were announced earlier this month. And again, a big kind of criticism of some of these changes is, in particular, the person who is coming in as the new head of the commercial airplanes division. And that's the part of the company that manufactures the planes that passengers like us fly on. This person who's coming in is another person who has a business background as opposed to an engineering background. And so the experts and the industry watchers who I've spoken to about this over the course of my reporting have said, but that's kind of a curious decision, because in all of this, the big criticism is that Boeing has moved away from its focus on engineering and moved towards this focus on economics and kind of its return to shareholders rather than the actual physical product that it makes. And so this person, Stephanie Pope, who's coming in, is really going to be under a lot of pressure to emphasize the engineering and the product side. And a lot of people are pointing out that that's not really her background. So she's really going to be under a microscope, I think, as she comes in to see kind of how she performs in this role overseeing the production of Boeing's commercial aircraft.
I was interested to read a comment from one observer of the shakeup at Boeing, and he said he viewed it with resigned exhaustion. I think that phrase gives you a very good idea of the optimism with which their bench is viewed, you know. I'm very interested in you talking about the other parts of the company, which we might not necessarily always identify Boeing with. So we see them as a commercial airline manufacturer. But what about their defense business? How big is that? Is that growing or receding?
So I don't know the exact numbers behind the defense business, but I can say with certainty that it's a huge part of Boeing's footprint here in the U.S. They're a major defense contractor for the U.S. government, and it's a really big part of their business. Similarly, you know, they're involved in space products, and also they do servicing for their products and for other airlines. And Boeing is a huge company. We think about the commercial airplanes the most because that's what most people who aren't in the industry interact with the most, but it's a really giant company. Naturally, in the course of reporting about these executive shakeup at Boeing, one of the experts who I spoke to pointed out that some of these criticisms really extend beyond just the commercial division to also its defense division and space division, that across the company, these criticisms seem to be levied that it's not focusing as much on engineering. And certainly we can see in some of its defense contracts that many of those products are also, you know, over budget, behind schedule, not up to par in terms of quality, or at least that's what kind of industry observers are saying. Mm. One thing I do want to emphasize in all of this, though, and I think it really bears repeating whenever we talk about this, is despite all of these criticisms against Boeing and some of these high-profile safety incidents that are certainly scary, Boeing airplanes overall remain one of the industry standards for commercial travel. So even though we're seeing some questions and maybe some cracks in their record and certainly in their image, flying remains an extremely safe way to get around. And I just think that that's worth kind of bearing in mind, that we're talking about problems, and they are big problems that are worth addressing. But in terms of the overall safety of flying, these big problems still remain essentially on the margins, because we haven't seen major accidents in the Western world when it comes to flying in a very long time.
Mm. Well, one person who certainly agrees with you on that front is Michael O'Leary, the chief executive of Ryanair. Obviously, we have an interest in all things Ryanair as it was, you know, started here in Dublin and now obviously one of the most successful commercial airlines in the world. But Michael O'Leary is very much sticking with Boeing, and he's also hopeful of a new person coming in making changes. But when does that reputational question start kicking in for consumers, in your view, Zach? Because as you say, at the minute, you know, there's not that flight, if you forgive the pun, away from Boeing aircraft. But do you think that there's a tipping point, or have we reached that yet, or do people just not care that much about the boardroom antics?
You know, it's such a complicated question, because I think there is a lot of attention among consumers and travelers, regular travelers like us. We're really paying attention to what's going on at Boeing in a way that I'm sure Boeing doesn't love, and also that most people probably haven't done in a long time. Most people don't really think about what planes they're flying on. Where it gets more complicated for consumers is, even if we're thinking about it all the time and people say they may not want to fly on a Boeing plane, I mean, I've seen posts like that on social media loads of times over the past few weeks. At the end of the day, unfortunately, consumers themselves, the traveler, does not have a huge amount of choice. For Boeing and for Airbus, which is really Boeing's main and only significant competitor in the commercial airplane space, it's really the airlines who are their customers and not us, the travelers. And so it's really up to airlines to decide if they trust Boeing enough. And they seem to be standing behind Boeing. As you said, Michael O'Leary at Ryanair continues to say that he has faith in Boeing. If I'm not mistaken, Ryanair is an entirely Boeing airline, much like Southwest here in the United States. And so it really comes down to how airlines are spending their dollars. Mm-hmm. And the other complicating factor is Airbus doesn't have enough capacity if Boeing were to go away. There just is so much demand for airplanes. These two manufacturers are pretty behind in their order books as it is. There isn't really room for Boeing to kind of disappear, or even for airlines to walk back from Boeing too much, because there isn't enough production capacity at Airbus or other companies to make up for it if Boeing kind of disappears from the scene. Mm. And travelers who may be choosing to book flights often don't really know what plane they're going on. That information isn't always the easiest to find. And many people who may only travel by air once a year or less may not even know where to find that information. So it's a really complicated picture when you're talking about sentiment. versus how much power people have to affect change in this area.
Yeah, I think you're 100% right. If Michael O'Leary has a concern, it's about the supply of the number of planes and nothing more than that. Zach, just finally before we leave this, I want to go back to the boardroom and get you to do a bit of crystal ball gazing for me and see who you think might take over as CEO and what that person needs to do to try and steady the airline.
Sure. So I'm not super familiar with the horse race in terms of personnel and who's likely to come into Boeing. I know that they announced someone who's coming in sort of immediately when Dave Calhoun retires. I'm not sure if that's an interim person or someone who's planning to be there for a long time. But the bigger question, what this new person, whoever it turns out to be, is going to have to do is really kind of drill down on restoring Boeing's reputation. You know, the ask here isn't to do a quick fix and make the Boeing 737 kind of, you know, the best plane in the world again. It's already one of Boeing's best sellers. The real challenge for the leadership team at Boeing is going to be restoring the reputation of this huge company that has really been tarnished over the last few years with high-profile safety incidents and hundreds of deaths.
Okay, Zach. Well, look, thank you. Some great points made by you there. And thanks for taking the time to go through all of that with us today. That was Zach Wichter from he's the travel reporter and cruising altitude columnist for USA Today. Zach, thank you very much. You're listening to News Talks Taking Stock. Coming up, as the US and UK sets out a deal to pool technical knowledge, information and talent on AI safety, we ask what it means and if the Irish government are doing anything to plan ahead for AI in Ireland. That's coming up after this short break. You're welcome back to News Talks Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnson. Now, for our final item today, we're going to take a look at what happened in the US and the UK this week as they signed a landmark agreement on AI. And when they did so, they became the first to formally cooperate on how to test and assess the risk from that emerging technology, AI. So I'm delighted to be joined now by Lee McGowran, who is with Silicon Republic, and he's going to tell us all about it. Lee, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Hi, Mandy. Thanks for having me on.
Now, luckily, this is a big deal and it was a big story in the front page of the Financial Times this week. So you might just give us some detail about what the agreement actually was between the US and the UK.
Yep. So basically, it's around AI safety and AI testing, essentially. So the US and the UK have agreed that they're going to essentially link up both of their respective AI safety institutes to work together on research and safety evaluations and guidance for testing AI models and making sure that AI models are safe for the future. So what really makes this stand out to me is the fact that they're not just planning on sharing information and doing research collaborations. They're also planning to exchange personnel. So the goal is to, you know, make the best possible kind of forms of AI safety testing for the future. And then also to bring the best, I guess, the strengths of both of their respective safety institutes together to form a joint form of AI safety testing. So it's definitely a big move in the right direction, I would say, when it comes to regulating the potential dangers of AI.
Yeah, now you say it isn't, it's a big initiative to bolster the agencies that they have already both announced last year, but it's not actual regulation. It is an information gathering exercise. And so why do you think that it is happening in this way and that they're not moving to regulate and that they are just stopping short at that information gathering point where you look at the EU maybe perhaps and they're already trying to set out regulation? Why are the US and the UK doing it a different way?
Good question. I mean, I guess we're in the developing stage when it comes to AI and AI regulation. I mean, countries around the world, including the EU, are still sort of figuring out the best way to regulate this. It's a very much a developing technology, and that's going to continue for the next few years as well. The EU's AI Act is an attempt to sort of get ahead of the pace of this technology with sort of broad regulation. The way I see the US and the UK's plan is that they want to lay the foundations for how you test AI models for their safety in the future. So that's sort of why they're doing it for the information side. They want to sort of evaluate the best practices that organizations can do to test models. And then hopefully that will kickstart all future testing and evaluation for AI safety. So it's sort of, it's laying the groundwork for how we actually test these models. Because again, whether it's regulation or information gathering, I do believe governments in particular and organizations are playing catch up to the technology itself. The technology has surged ahead in the last year and a half particularly, and we're sort of seeing a catch up thing. So you need to lay the groundwork of how we actually assess these models, what's the best way to do so. And I guess combining these institutes and doing that research will hopefully, you know, make that as best as it can be for years moving forward.
Now, as you say, look, this whole evolving technology is in its infancy, and I think everybody kind of accepts and respects that. But just to put a cynical hat on for a second, you might look at this and say, well, maybe one of the reasons why the US and the UK are not moving forward toward regulation before they do this assessment is to make themselves a tad more attractive to perhaps an industry who doesn't necessarily really want to be regulated.
I would definitely agree with that to a degree, to an extent, I would say. I mean, look, we've seen that problem. It's always a balancing act when you've got an emerging technology for governments. It's like, oh, we want to rein this in, but we also want to make sure our country is still, a good spot for other companies to invest in, that we're actually investing in our own companies, that we're not restricting innovation. We've even seen that with the EU's AI Act. There was sort of contention in the few months before it got fully agreed on because certain countries were concerned, oh, we're too strict on regulation, we're going to impact our own developing AI companies. So that is a tricky one. I would say that definitely is an element. I can only say I hope that regulation becomes the forefront in the future because, you know, this technology is fantastic, but there's definitely risks associated with it. And if they're not dealt with as the technology keeps growing, we'll see certain negative examples in the future. I'm already seeing negative examples now, even in its infancy. So I would agree with that. Probably is an element of they don't want to push too hard with regulation. I guess like the AI Act in the EU and with this, it's the proof's going to be in the actual results. You know, it's all talk currently. So we can have high hopes, but I guess it all depends on what the actual results are in the years to come.
Yeah, and you mentioned earlier that we're already seeing some negative aspects of the development of AI. Can you call out a few of those for us? What examples do you have of those?
Well, a big one at the start would be, from based on my field, would be cybersecurity. So we're already seeing examples of, over the past year, of AI being used as a tool for malicious individuals to conduct cyber attacks. So, you know, cyber attacks is already a serious issue around the world. AI has given criminals the tools they need to actually make their cyber attacks more effective. That's definitely them pushing other companies sort of have to use AI in their own security practices to keep pace. So it's sort of starting a security arms race. And then there's also issues. I mean, you know, even if you look at simple things like ChatGPT and people turning to these AI models as a source of information, I mean, they are very commonly accurate. But there's examples out there in various sectors where these machines have what's known as hallucinations, which is a very polite way the industry refers to as they get something completely wrong, essentially. So that could be naming somebody as a criminal when it's completely false, sharing articles that don't exist, just a weird mistake in the machine itself. But that can be a small issue if it's, you know, just a general knowledge. But with plans being in place to put these machines into so many different sectors, you know, healthcare, for example, we've seen examples of getting it wrong already. And I think if they're implemented into more, you know, vital sectors without being looked at properly, you could see them getting wrong with disastrous results.
Yeah. And we did see some figures out this week as well from Google who proved that point exactly, that more and more people are using ChatGPT as a kind of information source rather than something to use and help with production. Actually, it's a very interesting exercise for anyone to do. Just type your name into ChatGPT and see what comes up. I came up as a well-renowned DJ. So, yeah, they definitely need to fact check a little bit more. If you're just tuning in, this is News Talks Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston. I'm speaking to Lee McGowan, who's science and tech journalist with Silicon Republic. And we're speaking about the US and UK deal announced on AI earlier this week. Maybe, Lee, we just take a moment to look at other jurisdictions. You mentioned that EU AI Act. Do you think that they're successful in trying to bring more and more member states into that regulatory piece? Or is there any kind of pushback there to try and do for member states to go it alone in the same way maybe the UK and the US are?
I think there's going to be some conflict among the EU members. I don't think everyone's in full agreement. And again, the MEPs had a landslide vote in it, but I think certain countries, you know, might not necessarily follow everything to the letter. Certain countries, before it got fully agreed on, were sort of pushing against some forms of the restriction because they have their own up-and-comer generative AI companies that they're trying to kind of hone in to compete with the likes of OpenAI in the future. I don't like any regulation. I don't think all the countries are going to be fully on board. Mm-hmm. But I think overall they will be on board. And obviously overall there'll be, you know, the tools will be in place in the years to come to penalize those that don't. But the other issue is certain experts have issues with how the AI Act is in its final form. Certain experts I've spoken to have said that kind of relying on these AI companies to regulate themselves to a degree. They have to decide. Essentially, the AI Act is all about labeling AI models based on risk. So if your AI system is high risk, then you need to, you know, take more measures to ensure it's being applied safely. But to a degree, some experts are saying that, you know, the onus is on the companies to decide if their machine is high risk rather than regulators. So I don't know. We're going to see how it actually plays out in the years to come. It's going to be a few years until it's fully in place and being enforced.
Mm.
So companies have a time to get ahead of it, but I guess we should, I remain optimistic that it will actually be effective.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, I think politicians have been scarred by trying to play catch up with platforms and networks. So maybe in this instance, they're at least trying to get ahead of the game. I might just look a little further afield if we can, Lee, at this subject. What about China? Because we often hear about controls in their systems. What's happening there in relation to AI?
Well, China does have its own forms of AI regulation. And from what I've been reading, some wording in their documents in recent years have similar things to the EU's AI Act. You know, there's certain things of sort of, you know, preventing AI from being used for certain negative purposes, like, you know, creating massive amounts of fake accounts or promoting addictive content. AI has been shown to be very effective at manipulating people and sort of, you know, getting people into things in an addictive way. But other aspects of their regulation are a bit vaguer, and we've seen examples of them using AI a bit more, I would say, liberally than other countries. The likes of social credit scoring, where you are using surveillance to sort of quickly tell who anybody is on the street, and then, you know, they're associated with a credit rating based on that individual, sort of personal profiles for their entire population.
Mm.
That's the type of thing that can only be done with large amounts of surveillance accompanied by AI. And that's one thing in particular that the EU's AI Act is fully against. That is listed in as, you know, too high a risk to even consider, essentially. So
it's all very black mirror, isn't it? That collecting of data to analyse them on behalf of the state. But as I understand it, and I could be completely wrong, I don't think they allow access by platforms directly with algorithms to the public. Is that right?
To my knowledge, I mean, China is very much, you know, central government focused. So it would be more within the government's domain than going to platforms. That would be its biggest difference, I suppose, in the likes of Western countries. I would say China definitely is doing its own forms of regulation. And there's also certain elements of, you know, you get misinformation from certain countries, which is exactly what China is doing, sort of a fear mongering. But lots of experts do say China is the more extreme user of AI in recent years, and that probably will continue in the future. They'll probably use it a bit more radically than certain other countries will, and that's particularly in the likes of surveillance.
Mm. Look, before I let you go, Lee, I wanted to ask you briefly about one other subject you were writing about, which is related to this issue this week. You were talking about more than 200 musicians have asked AI developers and tech companies not to use AI music generation tech. What's their concerns and what are they hoping to achieve?
Yeah, well, this goes into various creative industries, musicians, authors and the like. Basically, they're concerned with how their music or their content is being used to train AI models. And then these same AI models are then used. So, you know, for example, there's AI models that will create, you know, artificially generated music, and it can then sound like popular artists because it has their songs in their training data. So these 200 artists, which include groups like, you know, Katy Perry and Billie Eilish and the like, they're basically saying that they haven't given consent for their data to be used this way. Mm. They're saying that this can be used to then create synthetic songs to essentially cut them out of royalties and hinder the music industry and, you know, and struggling musicians as a whole. So this is something you're seeing in, you know, various creative aspects. Artists have issue with AI-generated art. Authors are having issue with AI-generated printed works. The New York Times is currently suing OpenAI and Microsoft because they say that millions of their articles are used to train OpenAI and Microsoft's AI models without New York Times consent. So this is something, I mean, copyright in an AI and how AI models are trained, because they rely on such vast amounts of data, that's something that's going to continue for years to come, the issue of, you know, AI and copyright and exactly how they're being trained.
Absolutely. Well, Lee, as you said at the outset, we're just in the infancy of all this, and just this issue of AI and technology is now so pervasive in business, in politics and in our daily lives. It's something that we're going to spend a bit more time looking at over the course of the coming months on Taking Stock. But for now, we're going to have to leave that subject there. That's Lee McGowan, science and tech journalist with Silicon Republic. Lee, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks very much, Mandy. Appreciate it.
Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock, why we broadcast at this time on Sunday mornings. We're always available as a podcast first from Friday mornings on the News Talk app. Thanks to all of my guests today for their time and their very valuable insights. Producer of Taking Stock this week was John Fardy, Simon Keane and Stephen Daunt were on research, and Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. If you have any comments on today's items, please do email us at takingstock@newstalk.com. We love hearing from you. Anton Savage is up next with all of your Sunday newspapers and lots more. But from Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston, thanks for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston, Sunday morning at 9.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.